Morning, everyone. It's morning for me anyway. Wherever you are, good time. Namu myo ho renge kyo, namu myo ho renge kyo, namu myo ho renge kyo. I'm going to continue. I'm going to try to finish up our talk, my talk, on the Diamond Sutra today. And rather than save, there's a couple of points I want to make, and I was going to save them for the end, but I really think, especially at this point, as the Diamond Sutra has transitioned slowly with some repetition of reinvestigating the same things, it is a conversation between Buddha and fictitious Subhuti. I've talked before on the Lankavatara and the Vimalakirti Sutra, that to understand these old sermons and words of the teachings, you have to impose upon them an awareness that these are constructed sermons, constructed dialogues as a teaching aid. They aren't actually a Buddha and a Arhat having a dialogue. This is a convention that's more easily seen in the translations of Nichiren and Shonen's writings, where, for instance, a conversation between a sage and an unenlightened man is, by its title alone, very open about the method being used. And in Western translations, I'm not sure if this is in Japanese as well, the format is actually stated: question, answer, question, answer. Obviously, the answers are all coming from Nichiren, and the questions are all coming from somebody that either Nichiren knows and gives them a pseudonym, or somebody that he simply invents, which is the main teaching device of Buddhism. So when you read a Nichiren letter or writing that takes that form, you know that this isn't a letter he's writing to a follower or a disciple specifically, but rather this is Nichiren teaching Buddhism. So a conversation between a sage and an unenlightened man, Nichiren and somebody who's not a Buddhist practitioner, or a Buddhist practitioner who's not practicing the Lotus Sutra, you'll find those conversations, number one, are generally lengthy, and number two, have exhaustive dissection of every point that Nichiren makes, as well as a tremendous amount of history and scholarship and other scholars to back up what Nichiren is saying. So Nichiren never stands on a pulpit and says, "This is the way it is." Nichiren's entire career is filled with, in fact, history records him as a reformer, because he's not a rebel or a new vision, a new form of sect, taking Buddhism in another direction. He's a scholar who shows the consistency of scholarship throughout hundreds and thousands of years to clarify the point that each of them is trying to make, which is very much following Shakyamuni's words, because Shakyamuni was very, very adamant about understanding the meaning of his sermons rather than the words of his sermon. So Nichiren follows right in that lineage of understanding the meaning and thereby assuming the responsibility of teaching the meaning. Make sense? All right. Now, in that spirit, the remainder of the Diamond Sutra that we're going to attempt to read today, if I can get off all of these announcements. I think it's much easier for a student, as we all are, to know ahead of time certain real aspects of this teaching and how this construction of teaching is, what is called skillful means. And when we get to the Lotus Sutra, you're really, really, really going to be immersed in that dialogue. But the Lotus Sutra confuses a lot of people because it just, it's not easily relatable. There are relatable examples in there. But what I mean is, without the foundational dialogue of all these previous teachings, you can sometimes be left out in kind of a fantasy land, or something that feels inauthentic or inaccessible is probably the best word, especially for we in the West, as we're not raised with this kind of thinking. And as the world becomes more and more homogenized and cultures shift and change, it's probably more universal now than it's ever been. Also a prediction of Shakyamuni. So here's the point I'm going to try to make it, but I think if it just sits kind of there in the back of your mind as we go through this, you'll have more moments when you go, I get it, because you'll have this idea in your head. So I'm not going to try to dissect it, because it took 50 years for Shakyamuni Buddha to do it, and it's taken the last several thousand years for scholars to expand on it and delineate it far better than I can. So I'm just going to give you a few ideas to think about as we enter this, okay? Enough blah, blah, blah. In the earlier writings, sermons and writings, not from Buddha, from scholarship, because as you know, Buddha never wrote anything. At the time, everything was done orally with daily repetition so that it really would get remembered word for word, until they then, after he passed, started to write things down. And so they used that scholarship was all memory, and a lifetime of repeating the same thing, or 22 years of repeating the same thing, you pretty much know it. You know the pauses, you know the punctuation and everything, okay? So there's often talk of the three bodies of Buddha. And I actually got a comment on a video, and I don't know if this person has, how deeply they've studied, or if they just picked up on something, as we all do. Sometimes something hits us wrong and we hear it too many times and we just have to address it. And then a little later we read more or listen more to what a person is saying. Oh, they already knew that. It's a very human thing, so I don't have a problem with it. But I thought it might bear repeating, and it's going to be repeated again in the form of my preparatory note for this discussion. I'm already 8 minutes in. The three bodies of the Buddha, evidently in earlier teachings, people took that literally, to think that there were three different bodies. In other words, because of our attachment to bodies, existence, self, I would reckon that would lead certain people to believe that there were three different Buddhas. First of all, ultimately, when the light goes click and you really see what this is about, it isn't about a person at all. Buddha is a state of mind. It's a state of mind that is uncluttered with attachments, desires. If other than I have to say, there's a desire to liberate others from suffering. In fact, as in human form, in a body, a Buddha is only there as a bodhisattva for the purpose of helping others. Otherwise, Buddha, and all of its bodies are really, in modern language, would be more embodiments, not bodies. Embodiments of what? Of a state of mind. A state of mind only because we're in samsara. When we leave samsara, the conditioned universe that we live in, that state of mind becomes not a state of human mind or a state of consciousness. It's not. It, as we, dissipates into potential, just energy. And that energy, as I've described before in the 3,000 realms in the single moment of life, is Buddha, but it's only Buddha from the perspective of samsara. Once we leave samsara, all of that, there's no need for any of that. There's no differentiation. There's no one here and other. There's no self and other. There's no body. No body. Nobody. Okay? So Buddha is skillful means. Buddha is the goal for our samsaric mind to perceive true, the truth of all living processes. They all are manufactured from potential and return to potential. What's potential? It's energy that isn't in the act of creating. Okay? Energy that's not, I won't say that it's not doing anything because that's not specifically correct. It's just quiescent. There's still a bit of noise in there. And this is what causes the friction that brings together certain energies that create other energies that conclude in what we hear about in the middle period of the teachings, the skandhas. The skandhas are collections or amalgams of energies that come together, and at some point they start to precipitate first thoughts, cognition, and what follows that right away, desire. And that desire starts to precipitate energy into matter. And that matter accumulates until it becomes, with desire, incapable of stopping manifestation in a samsaric form. Samsara is a condition wrapped around that roiling energy that makes it so. And as living beings in samsara, we can see where, like, if you were in the middle of the ocean and you're blindfolded, you'd just be wading along, and then at some point you'd be lucky enough to reach a shore, land, and everything would change in that moment. The blindfold would come off. You would be now here. You would be in a condition of samsara. Whereas in this is a bad analogy, but picture that floating in the ocean being your only contact. You are in the process of becoming. Becoming isn't well, I won't go there. But you're in a state in wading around the ocean of not experiencing anything but being in that ocean. And when you get to the shore, the blindfold comes off and people start talking to you. Suddenly, your whole mind changes. You're having to adapt and do all of this. The problem is that when that happens, you forget about being in the ocean. And the memory's still there because it's part of you. But there's so much going on in samsara that we spend so much time building new attachments, new desires, new wants, new, I need this, I need that, blah, 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 blah. It goes on and on and on at a ferocious pace. So Buddhism helps us get back to the reality of floating out in the ocean. It's not a perfect analogy, but it gives you an idea. So Buddha isn't three different peoples. It's three different aspects of how Buddha is extant in our mind. Okay, the ocean is wet, it's deep, and it moves. But all three of those aren't different oceans. They're all the ocean. Do you see? So what ends up happening as we deepen our understanding through Mahayana Buddhism is that what helps us get back to that ocean, it is critical that we help the people around us get back to that ocean. Because if we don't, then our success is very selfish, it's very closed in. And everybody around us looks at us like we're nuts and put us in a rubber room. But if we help them to understand what we're doing, and that in the process, several of them get curious or enchanted by what we're talking about, and they start to go along that path, now we're gaining our own embodiment, our own body starts to expand, because the body is what? It's mental. So what we're doing is not accruing people of every color and race and job and knowledge base and whatever. We're accruing a larger ocean, a larger mind, not just the lagoon we landed in, but many lagoons, many, a greater, a bigger, more powerful vision in the mind of the ocean. And what does that do? It gives us a much bigger connection with what we came from and where we're going back to. So our awareness can only grow by the same proportion, immensely. So a practice of Buddhism that only takes you to getting yourself back to the ocean is extremely limited. I mean, it's powerful, of course, but it's harder to do. It's going to take you longer to get there, and a lot of people just won't succeed. But expanding your practice from a self-motivated, even if you understand everything, if it's only for you, you may not get there. And if you do, you're going to be isolated. You're going to be, in my analogy, I suppose you could be a lake with a tributary to the ocean. I'm trying to make visual diagrams here for you to get what I'm talking about. So this is why Mahayana is so much more exactly what Shakyamuni set out to do. His idea was, I'm going to find a way to escape this human problem of pain, of disappointment, of sickness, of health problems, of old age, of the trauma of birth and the worry about death. Because that's not what life is. But I got to figure out the answer. And if I do figure out the answer, the only way I will know that it's the answer is that it won't be just the Brahmin elites that'll practice it. It won't be just these kinds of people or those intellectuals that'll get it. This practice has to work for absolutely everyone, no matter what their status. If I can find that, then I found the truth. If I can't find something that works for everybody, then it can't ultimately be the truth. It's maybe a part of the truth, or it's a convenient truth, but it's not the ultimate truth. This was his whole goal. All right? So, the main point is that you kind of have to think in a duality, and we are in samsara. This is all about duality, so shouldn't be hard for you or anyone. These conversations are teaching tools for you to understand each and every one of us, each and every one's sentient being, to understand the relationship we have with our own mind. Okay? So any interlocutor that Buddha has, Buddha being Shakyamuni, is an opportunity for Shakyamuni to teach something to get that pupil further. Whether it's a colorful name of a bodhisattva, or another Buddha, or an arhat, as in this case, somebody from an earlier teaching, as in this case, and he's trying to bridge them to using what they know, but in a way discarding it as well, because it's an obstacle. It's stopping them from growth. And he wants to get past that. And he says this in many sutras. Discard everything I've told you before. Now this. It's not because everything he told you is a lie. And he explained when we get to the Lotus Sutra, you'll see in the Immeasurable Sutra, the opening to the Lotus Sutra, the preamble, if you will, specifically says this. So I'm excited to get there, but I don't want to get there too fast. I think it's important that I demonstrate in my videos and in my life what I'm telling you guys to do, what the Buddha has told us all the time to do, is study broadly, because that will help you get there. If you just start with the Lotus Sutra, it can be overwhelming, confusing, and you may walk away, and that would be tragic. So very important to study beyond that, so that when you re-study that Lotus Sutra, a lot of light bulbs go on. Okay? So that's what we're doing. Without further ado, I know I'm talking. Where did we leave off? Let's see, I used a different marker. Now, I'm going to choose to read quite a few of these passages because, and this is, I think, why I was motivated to have this little talk before we continue, because there's so much. Now that Subhuti has learned a few things, and remember, he went into tears when he finally broke through the understanding that arhat weren't it, but that there was so much more. It just broke him down. And this, again, these are fictitious people, so understand that this is the Shakyamuni sympathizing with a practitioner who, like, okay, I led you to believe you were doing really good, but only so that you'd learn that. Now let me show you how to use what you've learned to go way beyond it. There's a beyond it? That can be pretty traumatic, all right? Anyway, so now we're in the 16th chapter, and there's 32, so we're right in the middle. But as you can see from the book thickness, the last half has some brief chapters in it, so it goes pretty quickly. But there's a significant shift here, okay? So let me start. Yeah, I'm just going to jump into it. I don't think we need, I've talked enough about this. All right. Bodhidharma, quite a famous character in history, commented as they begin this chapter, says, quote, the karma of the three realms comes from the mind alone. See? If your mind isn't within the three realms, it's beyond them. Now, that's not just important from the standpoint of the three realms and where karma comes from. This is little k karma, because in the Lotus Sutra, we'll find out about capital K karma that goes throughout time. Or, in truth, there is no time, but it's the karma I was talking about earlier when I talked about energies kind of combining, getting together to start forming a motion, a will, a volition of its own. Okay. That's a type of karma that's very difficult to change because it happens before we were we, before we were attached to an identity, before we were born. This is why in birth there are three entities, not two. There's the mother, there's the father, and there's this third karmic entity that chooses the combination of those two as a good fit. Not because they're a good fit because they fit like a puzzle, well, maybe so, but not like genes, but a fit because those karmas, those energies need to interact. And sometimes it's not pretty, but they need to interact in order to break apart effectively and seed the quiescent energy with less turmoil, I'll say. Even turmoil and quiescence. It says many times in the teachings, it doesn't translate well into words, but we try. If your mind isn't within the three realms, it's beyond them. So right away, you see the duality here. We have the three realms, okay, that we exist in, and there's something beyond samsara. So it's always been there, it's just not always explicit. The three realms correspond to the three poisons. Greed corresponds to the realm of desire, anger to the realm of form, and delusion to the formless realm. Boy, you can certainly see that in the world today. And because karma created by the poisons can be light or heavy, these three realms are further divided into six places known as the six states of existence. And Zen teaches a lot about this, but we're going to get past that. Yi Shun says, a Chinese scholar, karma is the residual force of actions. Whether actions are good or bad, they depend mainly on the mind. So I've often said Buddhism is about attitude. That help? Thus, the presence of exceptionally strong wisdom or resolution can cause karma to change. Again, this is karma that we're creating in samsara. If we're creating it here, then we can certainly change it. Ask anyone who's quit smoking, or any kind of habit. Some are more hard to change than others. Some of us can change the same habits far easier than others of us. If there's not a good measure of karma, there's one. Karma means what is possible, not what is predetermined. So right away, this is a strong statement about Buddhism. It isn't about destiny or predestined or manifest destiny, any of those. Because right there in that one sentence, you can see that there are so many variables that there's always influence and influenced. All right? And I've said this before too, that once you attain awakening, at some level, what you're doing is breaking away from those influences, and your ultimate enlightenment will be, and this is why you have to deal with others and not just alone, because when you're alone, you can just for yourself release yourself of your own attachments, but attachments continue to exist everywhere around you, so you've really kind of closed your mind. And Buddhism is not about that. It's about opening it up to the point where it's released. Liberation. Thus, Buddhism stresses past karma but does not fall into the doctrine of fatalism. I thought that was an important statement. So I wrapped it in yellow. I don't know if you can see that. There we go. All right. One of the most important teachings of Buddhism's Mahayana revolution is the instantaneous elimination of lifetimes of karma. Now you understand those lifetimes aren't samsaric. Those lifetimes are the process of the nidana, the descent into samsara. All right. And the equally sudden attainment of enlightenment. Most of the early followers of Shakyamuni felt that Buddhahood was beyond their reach, the beyond, and aimed instead for liberation from suffering, which they held could only be achieved by progressing through a series of stages, such as those mentioned in Chapter 9, whereby desires and attachments were gradually eliminated in the course of many lifetimes of practice. The Mahayana, however, approached liberation from the other side of the river. Remember, the body of water is always an analogy throughout many, many teachings of reaching the other shore, and Buddhism being a ship to cross the sea of suffering to attain the other shore, right? An analogy is used a lot. Blah, 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 river, where perceptions of time and space do not apply. What did I just say? There's no time. Time and space are a construct of our minds to be able to fit all of these other experiences in. The samsara. I know that's, just stay with me. But this begs the question as to how one reaches such an understanding. Here the Buddha supplies an answer. By suffering on behalf of these teachings, we speed up the process whereby our karmic obstructions are eliminated and enlightenment comes into view. For suffering on the behalf of this teaching necessarily involves seeing such suffering in the light of the teaching on whose behalf we suffer. Thus, our suffering becomes the source of our liberation. Now, what does that mean? Because it sounded kind of contrary to what we think we know about Buddhism. But this is what I prefaced with. If you, sorry, my robe's giving me problems. If you practice alone, your suffering is limited to you alone. But if you work to benefit others, if you try to teach and share teachings, your experience with others to help them get on the path, this is the goal. Not just to talk about how wonderful this is, but to inspire them to try it for themselves, to get involved in the study, to get involved in the expansion of their mind, to help them release themselves from their sufferings. What happens oftentimes is, as we already do, how many people have you been friends with in your life that have fallen away at some point because either it slowly drifted apart or there was a violent, and I don't mean physical, but a violent event that just made you walk separate ways? How many times have you confronted that in your life? You're already doing it, except that you don't have a motivation, strong enough motivation, to go back and try to heal it, try to fix it. So, look, I'm sorry, I'll eat crow on this one. Just please don't stop doing this because there's so much value to it. It's far greater than me. I want to continue to have you as a friend, and maybe our relationship's changed, but I promise you this change will turn out to be eye-opening and good for both of us. Please, please remain my friend. How many times have you done that? But when you teach Buddhism, that's that true compassion compels you to do that. So this is what Shakyamuni is talking about here. He's saying, okay, you've done all of this study and you've learned a tremendous amount, but if you don't help anyone else, if you're not determined to in any way, and this is key, you don't have to be a brilliant scholar. Look at me. Okay. I know a lot. I've studied a lot. But it's very hard for me to make quote unquote friends, because all of the friends that I make will very quickly get exposed to Buddhist teaching, whether it's explicit or it's implied or it's, I use skillful means. Sometimes I just keep repeating the same Buddhist thinking to solve their problems, and they usually feel like, wow, I never thought that way. Wow, that. So I know they're slowly changing. I see it over time. And when the time is right, and maybe it won't be in this lifetime, but it doesn't stop me from doing it. I will find ways to insert Buddhist thinking, Buddhist teaching. I'll quote it from now, timing it. And some of them do drift away. Some of them I attract. I don't even know them, and they'll come to me. And I find the online community is wonderful for that because there's a certain protection, a sense of protection of anonymity, even though it's false. They feel me more approachable because they can just, turn me off. That's why I do these videos. That's why I'm on Quora talking all the time, because I know I'm reaching avid students as well as curious onlookers as well as extreme doubters that are just trying to poke me. But it doesn't matter because my compassion is such that any exposure they get will be a seed, just a tiny seed. And the more of those seeds get planted, the more they will grow, even against their wishes, they think. So this is what Buddha, this is an important point. He says, if basically he's saying, if you now adopt his bodhisattva practice instead of the arhat as your ultimate goal, and your bodhisattva practice is solely engaged in creating a one-to-one relationship with your Buddha mind, your Buddha, the Buddha mind, then this is inescapable. You have to bring other people in the mix because you need their minds. And because of that effort, you're going to deal with samsaric negativity. You're going to deal with people who either are angry because you make so much sense, or they feel like you think they're better than they are, and no matter what compassion you use, they're just going to feel that because of their karma. And so there are sayings later on in Mahayana you'll pick up, like, everyone around you is your teacher. This is why they're your teacher, because you will get to peer into their minds, and you'll have to work out how can I work with that. And what you'll be working with is other karma than your own. And so your awakening, your awareness can only grow from that. And the more you do it, the more expansive your relationship is with the mind, the mind. Does that make sense? So this is what this is about. Our suffering becomes the source of our liberation. It's like we're putting add-ons on our V8 or our V6, and we make it a V8, and then we put a better carburetor on, then we get a blower, and then we just keep amassing more and more power. Of course, unlike an engine, we won't blow up, where our explosion will be an explosion of enlightenment. Okay? So, earlier in chapter 14, the Buddha cited his physical dismemberment by King Kali as an example of the practice of forbearance. That's pretty severe. Here he applies the same practice to emotional trauma. Both are necessary precursors to the spiritual trauma of birthlessness that bodhisattvas must forbear at the end of their path, a trauma the Buddha himself was able to bear during his life as the ascetic Sumedha, and as a result of which Dipankara prophesied his future Buddhahood. Again, this is all happening in the mind, right? This is a device. But it's a pretty darn hard-ass device, okay? Again, since I've explained to you what's going on here, I hope that these words hit you in a different ear. Okay, I'm going to continue. Sheng Chao says, misdeeds arise from delusion. Merit comes from understanding. As merit and understanding accumulate, past wrongs are eliminated, changing karma. And as they continue to be eliminated, understanding grows until one is able to reach enlightenment. Tao Wan says, thus are the unfortunate rebirths that you should suffer eliminated, and the reward of enlightenment obtained in their place. Yin Shun says, if you inoculate with smallpox so that you allow it to develop in a weakened state, you keep it from recurring in a more life-threatening form. Suffering contempt is also like this. So he's identifying a certain type of suffering, of contempt. Like the person you're talking to isn't always the one that gets pissed off and walks away. Sometimes you are. Sometimes you talk to somebody and they just scream back at you what they believe, like, you're an idiot, this and this, and, you know, my God does everything, or whatever it is, okay? And you can walk away from that feeling like, right? But then you should go, and this is when Nichiren says, desires are enlightenment. It's from this, okay? That if you take your emotions, and I've said this for decades now, emotions are the key to unlocking your karma, because emotions are completely constructed in the mind. I don't think I have to be too scientific to convince you of that. Emotion, or we can say it comes from our heart, but you realize in China, for instance, the word Shen is about wisdom and knowledge, and you would do it a disfavor to say it's the mind, because the concept in China is that the mind and the heart, two things that aren't organs but reference organs, are wisdom. It's not just the brain. They don't say the brain. They talk about the mind and the heart, feelings. Okay, and what do we do in Buddhism? We try to detach ourselves from feelings. So our emotions are, ding, little light bulbs. So as Nichiren says, rightfully so, as soon as you feel those emotions that are stirring you, chant, go meditate, chanting live meditation to a perfection, a mirror of perfection of your Buddha nature, single-mindedly conceive of your one-to-one relationship with the Buddha mind. And you'll immediately, well, it may take some chanting, but you will, instead of that festering as a negative thing that every single discrete moment of your life keeps re-instantiating, right? Every moment is a birth and death. Every moment. But that's rebirth. And so as you hold on to that contempt, you're transferring it to the next moment, the next moment, the next moment. If you go to your Gohonzon and you chant fervently, not even about that, just chant about your Buddha mind, that contempt will just, it'll shrivel up, it'll stop, and you'll be back on track again. This is the whole practice. Move on a little bit. Yen Ping, and you understand I'm doing this because I want you to understand once again, this is not just my opinion. This isn't just me saying these words. This isn't even just Shakyamuni's words. This is scholarship around these teachings, all using their own language to interpret and understand the meaning of these sutra passages. So it's like you've got a dozen teachers here that are in their own way trying to bring you to understand. I'm helping them with their bodhisattva practice, even though they may not even exist, but certainly the scholarship does exist, because these are actual people who studied these things and tried to transform it into something the people of their era understood. So you have close to 3,000 years worth of investigation in the meaning of these things here. And I'm trying to add myself to it, but I'm owing respect to these people because they helped me form my own vocabulary, which in my era, your era, mine together, we may, I hope, communicate these ideas more efficaciously so that we of the 21st century can hopefully, with something I say, go, oh, I just got it. Maybe when I read you what Yan Ping says, oh, you'll just get it, because we're all different, right? So, Yan Ping says, anyone who can uphold and recite this sutra will see that their own nature is like the sky, and they will at once realize that the nature of their karma is also empty. Remember what we said about empty, right? It's not physically empty. It's empty of any permanence. Everything is impermanent. I'm just a temporary assemblage of particles of dust and smaller. Okay. The smallest thing they go to in 3,000-year-old science is atoms. Amazing they were talking about atoms at that time. But take that to mean when they say atoms, they transcend atoms. What transcends atoms? What creates an atom? Energy. I'm giving you a little forewarning here because it's going to become real obvious. All right, Shen Yi says, karma has no nature. As long as we don't encounter prajna, wisdom, and remain unaware that karma is basically empty and without any nature of its own, we have to repay our past debts. Only prajna can wipe them out. When they talk about prajna, they talk about what this is about, perfect wisdom, the perfection of wisdom. What's the perfection of wisdom? Our one mind with the Buddha mind. So when we think in that way, concentrate in that way, those little moments of emotion that want to transfer from one moment to the next are stifled. They go away. This is what all of these people are saying in their own language, in their own era. Karma is created by our deluded mind, not our Buddha mind. But if our deluded mind is empty, it can't continue creating karma. Bodhidharma says, you should realize that all karma, painful or otherwise, comes from your own mind. If you can just concentrate your mind and transcend its falsehood and evil, the suffering of the three realms and the six states of existence will automatically disappear. And once free from suffering, you're truly free. Now that's important because something else I wanted to point out is that Buddha is not a goal. I know it sounds like a goal, but being at one with the Buddha mind isn't to become Buddha. When you are enlightened, and this is why they talk about sudden enlightenment, it's like if you're driving a Jeep through a cornfield and the corn stalks are your karma, you know, the effects of you making causes in this life. So I hate these kind of people. And suddenly you start meeting them everywhere. And they're just slapping you in the face like corn. And slamming the car, breaking the windshield, blah, 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 blah. All this noise. That's samsara. And then suddenly you pass the cornfield and break out into a nice light grass, firm ground meadow. And the Jeep just sort of sails through it. And all that noise is gone. It takes you a minute to adjust. You almost want to hear a choir, right? That's what Buddha is like. Achieving Buddhahood isn't about going some other place. It's about getting the corn out of the way. That makes mentally the cornfield in your mind that you're driving through, plummeting through. You start to understand that the corn doesn't really exist. It's hard to convince yourself of that because it's making a lot of noise. It broke the windshield for crying out loud. Oh, guess what? The Jeep doesn't exist either. Oh, and nor do you. Suddenly the corn is gone, the Jeep is gone, and you're just, oh, this is so amazing. That's enlightenment. That's awareness. But it's hard to get there. Got a lot of work to get there. That's why you need the help of meditation. That's why you need to chant. That's why you need to focus your mind on this liberation, this Buddha mind. Because if you do that, your attention will be more on it eventually than the corn. You know, this is where a positive thinking came from in the 70s. They studied Buddhism. And they thought, how can I make this secular so everyone can achieve something? And so you're a football player and you think, I can dance like a ballerina out there and avoid all tackles. And it changes. You really pound that into your head and you put it on your refrigerator and your walls and your mirrors and everything. What are you doing? You're changing the training of your mind. Your mind is so now focused on this vision that it ignores anything that's trying to be an obstacle to it. And sure enough, you go out there and you may just look like you caught a great pass and made a touchdown and everyone cheers you. But in your mind, you felt like a ballerina. Just whoop, and here I go, and this is amazing. And you get into the end zone, and you have a sort of a rapture, you know. I'm not saying that's awakening of Buddhahood. I'm saying the mechanism of training the mind is a supremely powerful thing. And if you point your mind to the ultimate awakening, you will get there. You will feel it. And when you experience that, you want to stay there. In samsara, it's difficult. You go in and out of it. Until you can maintain it, then you can call yourself someone with a Buddha mind. But you can't call yourself a Buddha because a Buddha doesn't exist. Okay? Subhuti, I recall the past during the countless infinite kalpas before Dipankara, Tathagata, the Arhan, the fully enlightened one. I served 8,400,000 million trillion other Buddhas and served them without fail. So that's what I was just saying. It's an effort. That's what all that, Buddhism uses, Shakyamuni used this a lot. But all of Buddhist scholarship uses this a lot. The idea of uncountable math. You know, math came from India. So everything, if you can just take numbers far enough that the human mind just breaks down. I can't conceive of that. Then that's the achievement of the equation. Okay, moving on. You know what? I'm going to get cut off, so we're going to have a part four. But I promise, now that I prefaced it with all of the stuff I've talked about today, we should be able to wrap this up with part four. I hope you're enjoying this, though, and I so much appreciate your partnership in this. I'm at 53 minutes, and the last time I tried to go past an hour, it just shut me down, as you'll remember from the way part one abruptly ended. So I'm going to stop this now, and I'm going to immediately continue and do part four. So if you've got the endurance, please join me, or you can watch it at some other time. Can't go over an hour, so at least you have that. But gosh, I appreciate your commitment. I know. I hope you get as excited about this as I am. Excuse me. That's my husband made me burp. Anyway, that's my goal. I hope I'm achieving it. Please comment. Let me know what your thoughts are so that I have more things to think about for myself to change my own karma. Let's help each other out. Okay? All right. Until next time. Namu myoho renge kyo, namu myoho renge kyo, namu myoho renge kyo. Thank you.